Hey, I was reading a fascinating story about a woman named Martha Corey. Anyone familiar with this story? I was familiar with kind of the scenario surrounding her story. I wasn't aware of her. She was a respected member of the Salem Village community, and she was arrested. She was really an upstanding citizen in the community. She was arrested and standing trial for various acts of, if you can believe this, witchcraft. This was interesting. Allegedly, the charges include causing illness or harm to others. She consorting with the devil. This was a charge. Possessing supernatural powers. This was a charge. It's like, whoa, okay. The court proceedings apparently were pretty chaotic and biased. There was very little evidence presented to her other than hearsay. All throughout the trial, she is protesting her innocence. She's going, this is not what I've done. She claimed staunch devotion to her Christian faith, in fact. Regardless, Martha Corey was convicted of witchcraft and sentenced to death. On September 22nd, 1692, Martha Corey was hanged, along with seven other victims of the Salem witch trials. Now, I was, as I'm reading through the story, I'm really curious. I'm not familiar with witchcraft. I don't know what that thing looks like, but I'm like, okay, what is the truth here? Was she doing some like secret behind the scenes spells or, you know, the cauldron? I didn't know what that looked like. I was like, I wonder. So I began to dig into deeper into the story. When you dig into this thing, you know what her crime really was? It was that she had refused to conform to the stringent doctrines of her Puritan community, the beliefs that they were holding. She was struggling with them. She was doubting some of this stuff. She didn't want to believe everything that they were saying. Witchcraft. Martha's independent thinking and her refusal to conform to these rigid doctrines marked her as a threat to the established order in Salem. Her execution sent shockwaves through that Salem community, serving as a grim reminder of the dangers of blind adherence to the dogma, but especially the devastating consequences of religious intolerance. Fast forward now to about 11 years ago. I got invited by a friend to go for coffee. Guy I love. Like a brother. We went out for coffee and, I mean, it's a guy we've vacationed together. Our families were very close. And he was concerned about my spiritual beliefs. I didn't know it when he set up the coffee, but it became very clear very quickly when we sat down. As a community, Friends Church had, prior to that, just come out as accepting and affirming of the LGBTQ community. We said, there's some things that have been changing in our minds around some of these issues, and we need to be more upfront. There have been times on Sunday mornings where I opened up about my own questions around some beliefs that I was raised with. And I was just publicly sharing some of my struggle with some of it. Obviously, word got back. He doesn't attend Friends Church. And so he wanted to have coffee. He sat down and began peppering me with a bunch of questions about the doctrine that I hold. He's says, I want to know where you stand on this belief. I'm like, are you okay, man? He says, I'm fine. I'm trying to figure out if you're okay. I said, okay. He says, where do you stand on this? And he would pick out one particular area of doctrine. I said, man, I'm not sure, pal. And at first I was like, oh, I could tell in his eyes he wanted a very specific answer. And I said, I don't know. It's like, what do you mean you don't know? You're a pastor. You don't. I said, I've been wrestling with this, and I'll tell you why. And so I start going into some of the complexity surrounding the doctrine. If this is actually the case, then this is the case, and this is the case, and I'm not ready to sign off on that. That doesn't make sense to me. So I got a big question mark. So we're going back and forth, and he says, okay, so what about this? I said, that is kind of tied into this. I said, I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying I'm struggling to understand it. It was a long coffee, and man, after it was all said and done, I felt like I had gone through the Inquisition, man. I was just like, there's one point where he looked at me and he said, Jeff, I used to think that we were like this, and now I realize we're like this. And I'm watching him say this, and I'm going, so what does that mean? Like our friendship? Like is this what we're saying our friendship is? That is exactly what he meant. That marked literally a parting of our friendship. Like a divorce. You know, I'm betting I'm not the only one in this room or group that are listening online to me today who have maybe had a moment, an experience with someone who just found out that you're on a different page than them in some way. Maybe it was about a spiritual belief that you don't hold that they do. Sometimes it's that way. Sometimes it's maybe something in your life that they didn't agree with. Many, many stories of people who moved in with a girlfriend and all of a sudden the church community abandoned them. They're like, oh, you're one of them. Came out with news of a divorce. Well, that changes things. Come out as gay. I could go on with a big list of different things where you can tell once the news dropped of whatever it was, there was a shifting in the relationship. It's just like, whew. Sometimes it's worse. All of a sudden the Inquisition comes on, people trying to rescue, fix. In the years that followed, I would hear through my boys of different offline conversations that this friend of mine would have with them. Little covert operations to try to make sure that they were not believing what I was believing. Trying to straighten them out, making sure they had that I hadn't led my own kids astray. Go from heartbreak to anger to seething anger. You're just like, how dare you? What? How is it that a deeply devoted spiritual people can turn their backs on loved ones? On their own? Over doctrine? Over dogma? That's what I want to talk about this morning. To do it, I want to talk about two paradigms of interacting with religious belief that I think lies at the heart of this thing. And because I don't know a lot of other religious traditions that well, I'm not going to speak on their behalf. I'm going to just speak to the Christian tradition that I've been raised in. And to be honest, even it's not the whole Christian tradition. It's just kind of part of what I have experienced of the Christian tradition. But I think the patterns probably weigh fairly true the wider you go, even beyond what I'm going to speak to. A large part of the problem seems to revolve around and circle around this word called faith. Faith. Much of Christianity has been built around the word faith, specifically with regard to one's ability to believe certain things. In Latin, the word faith has a number of different meanings, but one of them is built on the Latin word assensus. Assensus. The closest word we have in English to assensus is belief. Traditional Christianity over the last 300 years has really focused around this semantic range of the word belief, or sorry, of faith. Being a Christian and being a believer were almost, I think, in many, many circles, synonymous. If you were a Christian, you were signing up saying you believed specific propositional statements to be true. I've talked to many people and they'll say, well, I'm not really religious, but I'm spiritual. And so I'll press them in on that. And they say, I have my beliefs, something that they hold up here. Maybe you felt that way too. If you do, I would understand. You were a Christian because you believed certain things. This really happened as a result for me. Looking back, it seemed this shift to faith as belief really developed strongly throughout the Enlightenment of the 17th century. Now, if you've studied history, In around that time, 17th century, there was a birth of science. There were so many scientific discoveries that were happening. They began realizing, wow, that earthquake wasn't necessarily an act of God. There are these tectonic plates that start rubbing up against each other, and that can create disturbance. The tornado wasn't God punishing someone who had sinned. It may likely have been low and high pressure systems kind of colliding and creating these kind of things. All of a sudden, they're going, wait a second. What is God doing here? Is he doing anything? And so there's a lot of doubting, a lot of questioning, a lot of spiritual belief that was thrown into the ringer. People are going, I'm not sure if I believe. And the church reacted rather than going, well, hey, maybe there's things that we didn't even understand. Maybe we need to rearticulate our faith in light of these discoveries. No, they doubled down and they said, we don't care what frickin' thing you find out in science. Here's our beliefs. And if you're going to be one of us, if you're going to be a Christian, you are saying you have faith. You have the ability to believe these things despite even an absence of proof. It was during this kind of season where more and more Christianity became a reflection of your ability to believe these statements to be true. Some of them, for some who had science upbringing, and especially, I mean, I'm talking to people all the time. You've gone into university, you have science degrees or whatever, you're wrestling with spiritual belief opposed to some of the things that you understand about science. It's just like, oh my God, they feel untenable. But Christians were required to believe. Certain things were very important. Now again, if you've been a part of traditional Christianity, this will be just review, and there will be people within our community here who believe in these things that I'm going to talk about, and that's okay. Let me be clear. I'm not saying this is wrong. I'm just saying this was... There's foundational beliefs that people were called to believe, and this was a sign that you had signed up, that you were a Christian. One was a belief in the afterlife. This was a big thing. Being a Christian granted the ultimate goal and prize. That was eternal life in heaven. ultimately, this was kind of the primary reason why people would want to sign up for Christianity. Because it granted you an eternity in a beautiful place, free of suffering. Some of the pictures, I listen to some people and they're going, I don't know if I really need the streets of gold. I don't know if I'm really into the harps or whatever. But this idea of being living forever in a beautiful place, as opposed to the other, that was probably pretty important to point out. You sign up and believe these things. You believe that there is a heaven waiting. If you do this right, it's a wonderful thing. Part of the requirement of beliefs surrounded the Bible. There was this understanding that the Bible was the literal words of God. Now, whether God wrote everything down and faxed it down to a number of different authors, and they then scribbled it out, whatever, however that went down, there is this belief that every word has been written and chosen by God, and therefore is to be applied literally in the way that to every person in all places at all times. Not only is it to be applied, it is actually and factually true. So when you do the math and the Bible says the world was created in 6 literal days, it was created in 6 literal days, and don't doubt that. Roughly 6,000 years ago, that's how it went down. And if you're a Christian, you believe that. I know carbon dating says millions of years of the earth has been around. It doesn't matter. Here's what we believe. No Big Bang. Didn't go down that way. Care what you learned. Jonah and the whale. Jonah was in the whale for 3 days, don't doubt it. And he survived. It was a good story. I want to be careful because these parts have been a part of my tradition all my life, and they meant something to me. But there have been many people that I've spoken with over the years, so they're going, I'm wrestling with this. And that, I'm wondering if I'm a Christian anymore. There were statements about Jesus, that Jesus was the Son of God, that he was born of a virgin, that he died for his sins, God raised him physically and bodily from the dead, and that he will come back again one day. These were creeds, these were statements that literally it was proof that you were a Christian if you could sign on the dotted line saying, yes, I believe that to be true. If you could do all these things, heaven was waiting for you. You could be assured. You had no fear of death. There's no reason to worry. Come whatever may, an eternity was waiting for you. Now, if you couldn't subscribe to these beliefs, if you questioned them, if you were a Martha Corey, and you're going, some of this doesn't really ring. It was like witchcraft. And there was a bad place reserved for you. Now, we've talked about hell in a series called Fearmongering in the last year. And that thing got a lot of traction. A lot of people have questions around, what does lie beyond whatever? I'm not going to say too much about it, except that if you honestly believed, you can understand this, if you honestly believed that people who didn't believe the correct things were going to spend an eternity in hell. If you honestly believed that, and you spotted that they were flirting with dropping certain requirements, you can imagine what kind of reaction that would bring out in you. You'd be pleading with them. You would be doing whatever you can. Now, if you thought that they might actually be talking other people out of believing the important things, you can imagine the reaction that would bring out. I am not surprised for a second why that Puritan community hanged those people, because they felt they were going to infect the community, and hundreds of people, who knows how many, might end up spending an eternity in hell because she was being a bad influence. Let's cut this thing at the root. Let's keep her out. I understand why my friend was looking across the table with me over coffee going, Jeff, I'm worried. I am really worried about you, and I'm worried about your community. I get it. I understand. Talk about a wicked source of motivation, though, for doing what you're doing, though, hey? It's like the only reason you're showing up on a Sunday is because you are worried, man, if you don't do this right, if you don't cross all the T's and dot the I's, you might get the surprise that you never wanted when your number rolls up. You're going, I thought I did everything right. I thought I was... I watched all my life many people going through the motions, like you guys sitting here today, because in the back of their minds are going, if I don't do this right, there is hell to pay. That is a wicked motivation for spiritual journey. And that has caused a lot of problems. I'll tell you this, you get enough fear going on inside your life around this stuff, you will say the worst things to people when you sense that they are steering away. You will do things that later you will regret trying to keep them involved. And some of you are, you're victims of that system because someone did and said things to you that should never have been said, but they're worried that you might end up in a bad place one day. And so the means justified the end. Ends justified the means. Yeah. Sorry. It's important that you understand that there is more than one semantic range of the word faith than just belief, than just a census. There's another very important aspect of the word faith. And I want to talk about that one this morning. Before I jump into that, let me just say, if you look throughout Scripture, throughout the Bible, you will read stories of our ancestors who struggled with this very concept that I'm talking about. They weren't all subscribing to this. Love this passage in James, and I've used this just in the last number of weeks. James says, isn't it obvious that the God talk... So in this concept, it's this, these beliefs, these things, these philosophies, beliefs that we talk about, these theologies. All, isn't it obvious that God talk without God acts is outrageous nonsense? He says, do I hear you professing to believe in the one and only God, but then I observe you kind of sitting back as if you had done something kind of wonderful and impressive just because you're holding those beliefs? He goes on to say, isn't it obvious that faith and works are kind of yoked partners? Faith expresses itself in works? That the things that you do are works of faith? He says the full meaning of belief in the scripture sentence, so he's referencing a passage. He says, when the Bible says Abraham believed God and was made right with God, set right with God, that included his actions. It was Apostle Paul. He was one of the spiritual heavyweights, wrote more books within the Bible. He had this to say. He said, if I speak God's words with power, revealing all the mysteries, making everything plain as day. And if I have faith that says to a mountain, jump, and it jumps, and yet, I do all those things, and I can't love, I'm nothing. It was a well-known Bible scholar and author, the late Marcus Borg, who wrote, you can have all the right beliefs and still be in bondage. You can have it all screwed down in your head. All the technicalities you've done, cross the T's, dot the I's, and believe all the right things and still be miserable and relatively unchanged. I said earlier, there is more than one semantic range for the word faith. I want to talk about this other one called fidelitas. That's the Latin word Fidelitas, otherwise known as faithfulness. Fidelity is really the root of that. To demonstrate faithfulness to your spirituality. This is kind of the same as being faithful in a relationship, in a marriage, committed to it. You can say, I love you, but then it's how you act that says, I love you. It's how you live. This is another expression of faith. And this is a paradigm within spirituality. And if you've been around here, you've been introduced to it, maybe without even knowing it. It is much less belief-centered, much less doctrine-centered, trying to screw around and make sure everyone's got their exact right beliefs lined up in your head. Okay, you're good. Okay, can you sign on this contract? Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Check, 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 check. Great, you're good. No, this faithfulness paradigm puts the emphasis on a way of living. A lot of people don't realize that the earliest movements of the Jesus movement, the followers of Jesus, when that whole thing started to really get steam, were not known as Christians. They weren't saying, oh, there's the Christians, they're coming along. You know what they were known as? They were known as followers of the way. They were known not for their beliefs. They were known for a way of life. Interesting. Jesus was approached one day. People were worried. They're going, man, there's all these teachers popping up claiming to be representing the spirituality that seems you're talking about. But we're not sure we can trust them all. Seems like there's some phonies in there. Interesting how Jesus responded to them. He didn't say, okay, well, just make sure that they're teaching this and teaching this and teaching this. You know what he said? He says, you'll figure it out. You'll identify them by their fruit. By the way they act. He says, you can pick out an apple tree by looking at the apples on that tree. An orange tree. He says, you'll do the same. You'll know they're tied into the real thing by the way they act. It's a way of life Jesus was promoting. When I study the stories and the teachings of Jesus, it seems obvious to me. Jesus was much more bought into this faithfulness paradigm than the faith one. I'm not saying you don't need both. I'm not saying that. But if you look at the kinds of things he continually was role modeling and talking about, it screamed this faithfulness paradigm. They would get mad at him. He'd be in these establishments, hanging out with these people that the spiritual community had completely written off. They said, they don't qualify. What is he doing in there? Some translations say, why does he hang out with such scum? I think he loved it when they get upset like that. There were times when his own followers were breaking certain rituals, purity laws. They'd be getting busted for eating on the Sabbath or doing certain things on the Sabbath, eating the wrong foods. They're going, oh my God, you guys are breaking the rules. Jesus was continually looking at them going, you're missing the point. You're crossing the T's and dotting the I's, and you're missing the point of what this whole freaking thing is about. Life, people, relationships in Jesus' world, it seems, always trumped a census, belief, ritual, rule, technicalities. It wasn't about the head and the technicalities. It was about this heart and this constant concern for mankind. What was going on around the world that they're living in. This faithfulness paradigm, it requires a wider perspective. to see spirituality as more than just a matter of the head, more than just knowing the rules, what the correct beliefs are. It was funny, like Jesus would tell these stories and he'd paint out this story of this tax gatherer, you know, this real hated kind of character in their society at the time. And then he had this spiritual one, and he would tell this story, you know, and you'd say, okay, this one's praying, you know, right before like kind of judgment day kind of scenario. And this guy prays this way, and this guy, which one is justified? Which one's okay in God's eyes? And every time it was like, it was a setup. They're going, of course it's a spiritual guy. And he's going, mm-mm-mm. He was constantly surprising them. He's going, your technicalities and rules are going to surprise you one day. It's missing the point. Guy says, I'm trying to figure out all the commandments to follow. Which ones do I need to worry about? Jesus says, hey, look, let's just simplify this. Love God and love your neighbor. Can we just start there? They all hang on those two. He was continually orienting people around the point. Don't miss the point. So that's why, folks, when you're hanging around here, and we're up here talking on the odd Sunday morning, when it comes to the Bible under this faithfulness paradigm, we don't waste a lot of energy trying to prove that something that you read about in the Bible is factually happened. Truth is, we don't care if it happened. We're not going for the factual reality. That's not what gives it power. We're looking for the metaphor, the more than literal meaning of these passages. Asking the question, what does that story actually challenge me with? What questions is it challenging me to ask of my life? We spend no time trying to defend the factuality of the Bible. Waste of time. We think its power doesn't lie in its ability to be proven factually true. The metaphorical power of the Bible is undeniable in my mind, according to how it's changed my life. This faithfulness paradigm isn't preoccupied with the afterlife either. People every now and then want us to speak to the afterlife. Some people come in and they just want assurance, just telling me, tell me I'm okay. Because my family think I'm not. They've told me in no uncertain terms, man, I got a hot future. I'm looking at that. There have been people that say, I'm scared to walk in because I'm going to get struck by lightning. I don't know. I think my future doesn't look so good. What do you say? To which I'll say, I don't believe anyone knows how the afterlife works. And I would challenge anyone who would say otherwise to prove it. Is heaven and hell real? I don't know. Straight up, I don't know. But I'll tell you this. Heaven on earth and hell on earth are real. And some of you have felt that. I know I have. And I know this. I can create heaven on earth, or I can create hell on earth. I've learned I can be good at both. The faithfulness as a spiritual paradigm says, let's create heaven. Let's talk about things that will restore order in our lives and in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, in our families, within our kids' lives. Let's do beautiful things that just reek of God's goodness right here and now. This is what we can control. If you look back over this What Ends Wars series that we've been doing, you'll notice we've been talking about this faithfulness paradigm all the way through it. We just haven't necessarily said it. We're sneaky that way. Week one, we talked about the temptation to achieve peace through victory, the sense that says, I'm going to win, but it's going to require you to lose. We said, refuse that temptation. That will create hell on earth. And we're watching it on a global scale right now. People that believe, honestly, that they must conquer and crush, annihilate in order to have peace. Never ends well. Week two, we introduced the concept of raising all the boats. This concept that says, look at, if five of us here are winning, our lives are all good, but someone over there is just under the boot of oppression. Is that really winning? The spirituality of faithfulness, this paradigm says, what can we do over there to help that person win? Is there something? We told the story of the castle and the well about a spirituality that just simply gives a shit about our neighbor. It says it's not okay for just me to win. But there's people around me that I believe perhaps divinely are there for a reason. And I have some kind of perhaps spiritual responsibility to help them. And part of the spiritual journey is not just wrestling with how can I make my life better. It is figuring out how can I come alongside. Last week, Vince warned about the danger of certainty and how humility can play a powerful role in avoiding wars. This is all about creating heaven on earth. Soften your language. Don't act like you know. Soften it up. You watch the conversation grow. Watch the understanding. Act with curiosity. Lean in and listen before you arrive. This creates heaven on earth. We believe it's one of the most beautiful spiritual things you can do. May we be a people who avoids witch hunts. Who avoids drawing lines in the sand, forcing people to believe what we believe. May we see deeper and wider. May we see higher. May we not be motivated by fear. But may we be motivated by love. May we do things every day, even with people we don't understand or struggle with. May we look over those boundaries and see a human just like us who perhaps just needs something little from us that will create heaven in their life. May we never, ever be written up as a community remotely looking like this Salem story. May this community be populated with so many different walks and diversity. Because what matters is your ability to be faithful to a spirituality that creates beautiful things on earth. May we be known as followers of the way. That's my prayer.